Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
Monday, Monday, so good to me. Monday morning, it was all I hoped it would be. Oh, Monday morning, Monday morning, couldn't guarantee that Monday evening.
Hello and welcome back to the Story of Nowhere podcast. I am your host, Daniel McCarthy. Coming in with a off-the-cuff kind of episode here today, probably isn't going to run very long. I just wanted to share some of my own personal observations and judgments regarding current events, I guess, maybe would be a way of putting it, although not so much like looking at the news in particular, but just sort of commenting on the general climate, if you will, in American politics and society since, well, specifically since the election last November, but I guess more broadly, really in the past 10 years or so. Because, as I'm sure you've noticed, everyone, pretty much everyone, seems to be just completely jacked up and polarized politically, freaking out about this side or that side, or super excited about what's about to happen, or super fearful about what's about to happen. There's just all of this conflict and craziness brewing and clashing together all the time now. And I would say that in the past 10 years, this process of like political agitation has increased from the level that it was at before, let's say, 2015, 10 years ago, which isn't to say that there wasn't political agitation before that. There absolutely was, and I remember it. But I don't think I'm saying anything too controversial when I say that around 2015, 2016, it kind of got dialed up to 11. Here in America, the political right-left perceived divide between people and supposedly between factions of people who actually wield power in this country. So this episode is just sort of like general, I guess. I'm sort of zooming out and just broadly looking at society and at America at this moment. As I said, it's going to be an off-the-cuff sort of thing. So don't expect, like, crazy show notes, the likes of which you see in my JFK series. This is just more of, like, a casual kind of thing. Although there, of course, will be show notes, and anything that I say that may seem outrageous, I promise I will source, but this isn't an essay episode. Just, again, more of my own thoughts. So, of course, I wanted to do this episode because I do have a lot of thoughts and opinions and judgments on the current political climate here in America. But also, this little episode, I hope, will serve as a sort of cucumber sandwich, I guess, as you await the next installment in the JFK series. As I said in the introduction to, I believe, episode 39, crowd work, over-specialization is not good, and oftentimes people can be too zoomed in on a particular aspect of anything, and this causes them to sort of lose the plot, to lose sight of what's really important. So I wanted to do this episode talking about the current situation in American society, but also as a sort of way of taking a step back and going back to the basics of this podcast. Because, you know, you can listen to me talk about the Zapruder film for 2 hours, and maybe forget that actually my show is supposed to be about utopianism. The Zapruder film has to do with the JFK case, and the JFK case has to do with utopianism, as I will demonstrate later on in that series, but even so, getting that far into the weeds of this particular case, JFK, maybe will obfuscate for some people, like, what I'm actually doing with the Story of Nowhere project. So hopefully this episode will be sort of like a return to just talking about applied utopianism, wherein I'm just sort of using current American society and politics as the vehicle with which to do so. And then we can get back to JFK. Speaking of Kennedy, as I'm sure you're all aware, the JFK files have finally been released. And that's pretty cool, I gotta admit. But also, Trump has convened a task force of government officials to reinvestigate the case. Again. So, I'll just very quickly comment on this stuff, and then we can get on into the show. I'm glad that we got this document dump, and I'm glad that there appear to be no new redactions. Of course, I don't just automatically believe the administration's claim that this is the rest of it, that every JFK file has now been released and that's it, don't worry about it, there's nothing left. I'm sure there are other things. I'm not saying that, like, there's some smoking gun document out there that they're never gonna release. I don't really think that's the case. I don't think that's how these sorts of things go down. I don't think the actual order to kill the president will be found in some paper trail. But I'm sure there are other documents that just aren't included in this dump for whatever reason. And then, of course, more importantly, we're never going to get back the files that were destroyed years and years and years ago. So even if we do have all of the extant files, certainly there are many, many records that are just lost to history. But regarding what we did get, I'm specifically interested in information regarding anything medical having to do with the case, be it with Kennedy's autopsy or reports from Parkland Hospital immediately after the shooting, anything to have to do with Oswald's treatment or Governor Connally's. Any medical information that's borne out in these files will be very fascinating to read because, as you'll see in the next Kennedy episode, all of the, doctor-related stuff with regards to this case gets pretty weird pretty quick. So, anything new there would be fascinating. I'm also interested in seeing if there's anything on Operation 40 or on Operation Mongoose, specifically with regard to the personnel involved in these operations. These were anti-Castro Cuba operations that may or may not have something to do with the assassination of Kennedy. If you know about this line of reasoning, then you know about it. And if you don't, well, stay tuned to the Kennedy series. I'm also curious to see if anything new is revealed about Mexico City and whether or not Oswald was actually there. Again, one of those things that if you know, you know, and if you don't, just keep on listening. I'm curious to see if there's anything regarding individuals who would later go on to become Watergate burglars, specifically E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis, because it's long been alleged that those individuals were involved in some way on the ground in Dallas. And then there is a whole Nixon tie-in to this case later on, again, for a later part of the series. And then, finally, Israel. This is something that's not usually talked about among JFK researchers, the potential involvement of the state of Israel. Now, lately, it's become sort of a meme online, which is really interesting, which has provoked people like Ben Shapiro to hop in front of a camera and basically say, oh, why even bother studying the JFK assassination? It doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. Which is a really weird thing to say immediately after people start accusing Israelis of being somehow involved. Oh, don't worry about it. No, why would you even study the JFK assassination? Strange. So those are just some things that I'm keeping my eyes open for in the documents. But a word on this task force, the so-called task force. They just held a hearing, their first hearing, the other day, and I watched it, the whole thing. And I gotta say, so far, it is a farce. With few exceptions of the members of this task force, pretty much no one is focused. No one's got their eye on the ball here. Half of these assholes just wanted to talk about how great Donald Trump is for even convening this task force. Wow, we really should be thankful for him. And by the way, Hunter Biden's laptop was a really terrible thing. Like, okay, sure, but why? We're here to talk about JFK, dude. And then the other half of the people just wanted to say that, kind of like Ben Shapiro, JFK was a long time ago. There's really no reason for us to even be talking about it. What we really should be focusing on is how Donald Trump is a criminal and a felon and blah, 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 blah. So it's like, why are you guys even here? Do you even want to be here? Like, it's very strange. And then at one point, one of the government people was asking questions of Oliver Stone. You know, Oliver Stone, the filmmaker, the guy who made the movie JFK. Arguably, the only reason that anyone gives a shit at all about the JFK records or even thinks about them? Yeah, this chick didn't even know who he was and got him confused with Roger Stone, the former Trump advisor, or whatever he was. It's just embarrassing, very embarrassing. Most of these people just seemed underprepared, or maybe not even prepared at all, and like they didn't even want to be there. It was a mess, so we'll see how that thing goes. I am happy we got the documents, though, so I'll take what I can get. So, yeah, storynowhere.com, that's where all my stuff is. Check it out, tell a friend about the podcast, subscribe, whatever, repost it. You can repost my shit, by the way, if you want to. You can just post this on any of those websites that people post stuff on. Just go ahead. If you give me credit, that would be really cool. If not, what am I going to do? Fucking find you? Whatever. Just spread all this stuff out there. I'm trying to get people to listen to me for some reason. It's probably like deep-seated childhood shit that I haven't resolved. But whatever. That's not your problem. Enable my ego, man. I'm a millennial with an internet connection. Let's fucking go. So I'll say one more time that this is not an essay episode. This is an off-the-cuff episode. But I am a nerd, and so nonetheless, I still have something of a thesis statement for this episode, although don't expect it to be, like, proven in the way that I would go about proving it in, like, a long-form argumentative essay type of episode. This is just, maybe thesis statement is the wrong word. It's just kind of like a central core of an idea that I'll be talking around throughout this episode and hopefully convincing you of, or at the very least pointing you towards certain information or trains of thought which will help you to see where I'm coming from. So this quote-unquote thesis statement is, the MAGA movement, which predictably gained power by reacting to the excesses of the left, is, in fact, furthering and accelerating the ultimate aim of the deep state, including the left, which it claims to be opposing. That aim being technocracy, or what I've dubbed in episode 20, the doomsday device of this podcast, which still, by the way, is my highest performing episode, and in my opinion, maybe my most important episode so far, techtopianism. So go back and listen to episode 20. But yeah, so there it is. The rise of Trump, which I personally think in 2024 is far more significant and impactful than it was in 2016, was entirely predictable. It fed off of the ridiculousness of the woke left, and it ultimately serves the same agenda that the woke left serves, namely that of technocracy, or what I have dubbed techtopianism. Now, I know some may feel inclined to accuse me of what the basketball fans call Monday morning quarterbacking. You know, oh, well, easy for you to say that it was predictable for Trump to win now that you're recording this months after the election. Yeah, maybe I'll go back and dig up some of the old conversations that were recorded that I had back in 2021 and 2022 when I talked about exactly all of the stuff I'm about to talk about in this episode, or then again, maybe I won't, because I don't really care all that much about if people believe what I'm saying regarding that or not, although it would probably, a lot of it, make pretty good bonus shows. So maybe I will. I don't know. Then again, maybe not. But if I do, it won't be because people are accusing me of making shit up. Don't really care about that. It was predictable. Absolutely. It's not Monday morning quarterbacking. I mean, maybe it is if you're going into your political analysis with like a really surface level face value approach. But if you know where to look, I think it was really, really quite predictable. Now, I don't really think that anybody, regardless of their position on the American left-right political spectrum, would deny that Trump and MAGA, whatever, got its fuel from the, I guess I'll say, excesses of the left. Now, there may be disagreement in that the left, I'm sure, at least people, certain people on the farther left, wouldn't see these so-called excesses as excesses at all. They would see them as the righting of wrongs and the popularity of Trump repudiating these, what I am calling excesses, is actually just an example of a return to bigotry. You know, he's halting progress. So they would see it as a problem, but nonetheless, we're talking about the same things. We're talking about the tranny stuff and the DEI stuff, woke stuff, blah, blah, blah. You know what I'm talking about. People on the far left, quote unquote, see that stuff as good. People on the far, quote unquote, right, see that as bad. We're still talking about the same stuff, regardless of how you want to judge it. So I don't think anyone on the spectrum, regardless of their position on the spectrum, would deny that that stuff, however you want to characterize it, played no small role in fueling this MAGA moment. And finally, I claim that even though the MAGA movement has this sort of veneer of resistance to the establishment, the ostensibly left-wing establishment, ultimately it will serve the agenda that the so-called left is itself serving, this being technocracy, or my term, techtopianism, because ultimately I see the MAGA right and the woke left as being part of the same system. I don't want it to be this way, but I mean, that's just what I'm seeing. And it's what I've been seeing for, well, like 10 years, 9 years now. But really mostly in the last 5. In the last 5 years, I think it's become very, very obvious. All right, so look. Everybody knew that Donald Trump was going to run for president in 2024. But if you remember, during the summertime, the early summertime, the media was reporting that his heart just didn't really seem to be in it this time. They were saying that the people weren't really interested, like they had been in 2016 and in 2020. That the whole MAGA movement had just kind of fizzled out. That the Trump train had left the station half empty. But if you recall, in 2016, they were also projecting that Hillary Clinton would win by a landslide. So much for our media. Well, then came July the 13th. Of 2024. Donald Trump got shot, and before exiting the stage upon which he was shot, he hoisted his fist into the air and, with blood running down his cheek, chanted, "Fight, fight, fight." Now, I found out about this and watched the footage, like, maybe an hour after it actually happened, and I thought, in that moment, as I'm sure millions of Americans did too when they first saw it, holy shit, he just won. And sure enough, not 4 months later, he did win. And just over 2 months after that, he was sworn in once again as the President of the United States. But the shooting was by no means the single or even the largest cause of his massive victory on Election Day. It was a captivating, spectacular event, which managed to further divide political ideologues, though ultimately I think in terms of just like the general moderate public, it probably drew more people to Trump rather than away from him. But as far as like political people go, his supporters, as far as they were concerned, this was proof that the deep state was out to get him. The bad guys needed him dead. And there are enough anomalies surrounding the details of this case to at least make it plausible enough. But then for the people that hate Donald Trump, yeah, well, it was probably just some lone nut who, for some reason, was also on the far right, I guess. Or, this was something else that people who don't like Trump, his detractors, that they threw out there. Maybe Trump staged it. Maybe he staged the whole thing to frame the left to make himself look like some super badass. And I mean, he did look like a super badass. You watch that shit. The dude gets shot, and then, clearly against the recommendations of his bodyguards, he presents himself to his crowd as blood is streaming down his face, raises his fist, and says, "Fight, fight, fight." Jesus. It's so good, I can almost... Maybe it was scripted. I don't fucking know. Look, if that was real, then that's incredible. And if it was fake, then it's the greatest propaganda moment of all time, maybe. It's certainly up in the runnings there. Good God. It's amazing. I'm not picking sides here. I ain't fucking woke, and I ain't fucking MAGA. I'm just saying, from a media consumer perspective, damn, that's good television. But look, I don't know what happened on July 13th. I looked at it a little bit, of course, the day of, like I said, I found out about it like an hour after it happened. So of course, I'm me. So I'm like Google Earthing the area that it happened and looking at the rooftops. And of course, you got to do that. But I don't know what happened. I'm still on JFK, guys. And if you want to do a thorough job, you got to like stick to one thing at a time. And I'm 60 years in the past. So maybe when I'm like 90, I'll get to this one. But what I do know is that the shooting of Donald Trump on July 13th, 2024, widened the gulf between both left and right. But the rise of MAGA in 2024, 2025, and its highly ambitious mission to overhaul the U.S. government is the result of far more than one, or two, or three, or however many it's been, assassination attempts against Donald Trump. As spectacular as, well, really just the one was, because you remember there was like a second one and then a third one, and people at work, I remember, were talking about there was like four. After the first one, it kind of fizzles out. Like, you get one. Anything after that, no one really cares anymore, apparently. But whatever, my point is that I don't even think the interesting one is what actually put Donald Trump into the position he's in right now. No. MAGA's real fuel, that which it burns in order to move, has been precisely that which it claims it is committed to eradicating: the radical left. The MAGA assertion is that this radical leftism has become the establishment. But was it always the establishment? As I'm sure you all know, MAGA stands for Make America Great Again, implying, of course, that once upon a time, America was great. So, its establishment, its social institutions, its government, and its culture were themselves great. Or at the very least, they didn't get in the way of Americans achieving greatness. But now, the establishment is occupied by radical leftists, and thus the MAGA movement, in response to this seizure, is anti-establishment and countercultural. Right? But from whom did this radical left seize the establishment? Back in the old days, back when, like, my dad was a kid, when it was the far left that the mainstream media and polite society derided as existential threats to America, the establishment, in the view of these leftists, was controlled by self-righteous, authoritarian, old-fashioned, conservative, old white men. The likes of Richard Nixon and Archie Bunker spring to mind. For the radical leftists of that era, the fuel waiting to be burned was not, of course, leftists, but the old conservative order. Now, fast forward a few decades, maybe to about 2010 or so, maybe 2015, and, well, that fuel, the old conservative order, that had pretty much been all burnt up. The so-called radical left was no longer radical. It was the established order. Thus, just as decades ago there emerged a left-wing movement to challenge the right-wing establishment, there has now emerged a right-wing movement to challenge this left-wing establishment. And we call that right-wing movement MAGA. Or I guess most people would say MAGA. I don't know. I keep saying MAGA because I'm studying Latin and that's the way that the A is always pronounced. So, sorry. MAGA, MAGA, whatever. If and when MAGA succeeds in its quest to annihilate the radical left, it will find itself as the new establishment. And then, eventually, there will emerge some left-wing counterculture to attack it. And on, the cycle will go. Forever and ever, amen. That all makes sense, right? Sure. Except that, what I just gave you, that's a very surface-level analysis. It assumes, first, that this is just a natural cycle. And that second, each side arises organically and battles the other side to the death, genuinely, each challenging the foundations of the other's ideology. As I said in episode 23, the Political Spectrum show, I do believe that there are very real, very fundamental differences between the right and the left. But I also said that the right-left spectrum Americans operate within doesn't actually span the entire political spectrum. Rather, it comprises a segment in the middle of the spectrum, and maybe kind of a small segment in the middle of the spectrum. In American politics, radical differences simply aren't that radical. Now, James Corbett recently published two articles on this idea of the political pendulum swinging back and forth. One moment it seems that the left wing is the anti-establishment set, and then suddenly it seems like the right wing, they're the anti-establishment ones. And he asks the question, and I believe answers the question, how organic is this swing, really? So, that said, I'll truncate my bit on this because Mr. Corbett, as always, does an excellent job of tackling those issues in these articles. So, I'll just implore all of you to read his two-part series and also check out his Questions for Corbett episode entitled, What Happened to the Anti-Establishment? Obviously, all of that is linked in the show notes. Anyway, what it comes down to for me is this. Remember those two assumptions I mentioned just a minute ago? The assumptions underlying that analysis I just gave? The first being that this left-to-right, right-to-left, left-to-right, right-to-left pendulum swing is natural. It's just a normal cycle. And the second one being that each side is organic and genuinely fighting against the other. Remember that? Because really, they're both just one assumption. I know I divided them into two, but really, it's one assumption, which is that all this cultural, political back and forth is organic and genuine. Yeah, I don't think that's right. I don't really know that anyone has any good reason to believe that it is organic. Obviously, wokeism was deliberately planted into the culture. People didn't just suddenly forget that the categories of male and female are real. Nor did the colorblind conditioning with regards to racial relations that we've all received since childhood for decades now suddenly reverse, being replaced by the view that race has everything to do with who somebody is and what becomes of them. This didn't just happen. Not naturally. These ideas grew within academia, beginning, to be conservative, with the sex and gender theories of the 1960s and 70s, though in truth, these theories go back even further than that. The revolutionary ideas and tactics of the likes of Herbert Marcuse and Saul Alinsky gave leftist professors in the latter half of the 20th century the tools to politicize and then radicalize their students. Now, these students are the professors to new generations of pliable minds. Now, normie moderates think that today's kids are just pussies, what with their being offended by everything and whatnot. And these normies aren't totally wrong. Current generations are pretty soft in general. But what these guys fail to understand, because they don't read Marcuse or Alinsky or any of the other new leftists who inspired the so-called liberals of today, is that rage politics is a deliberate tactic, not inherent weakness. If you watch, you'll notice that these so-called pussies aren't actually defensive or cowering at all. They're outraged. They are on the offensive. What did we used to call them? Social justice warriors? Now, I know that phrase was supposed to sort of be making a mockery of these people and their stupid crusade, but nonetheless, they really do have a sort of zealous, religious, crusader mentality and aggression when it comes to the promulgation of their ideas. And of course, conveniently, this sex and race theory stuff sort of spilled out of the universities and into the public sphere of conversation a little bit after that whole Occupy Wall Street and Tea Party moment, when the sort of grassroots populism that was fostered both on the left and the right, and I'm sure there's some sketchiness surrounding those movements as well, but nonetheless, these were movements, anti-corporatist, anti-1%, anti- maybe even deep state movements, that were gaining traction in the post-2010 era, and it's right around then that suddenly we start to hear all this talk about transgender bathroom rights. Remember? Like, that was the first thing that really kicked off this woke SJW phenomenon. The original conversation was who gets to go into what bathroom. That's sort of where the, like, sex and gender wokeness began. And then the, like, racial woke bullshit, if you recall, as far as I can recall, began in, like, 2015 with all of the sudden all these universities were freaking out about racist, quote-unquote, Halloween costumes. Like, that's where this kind of began in terms of the public awareness of this woke phenomenon. It was the tranny bathrooms and people dressing up like Indians, cowboys and Indians, at Halloween parties. And then it just went nuts from there. And the whole anti-1%, taxed enough already thing just sort of fizzled out because everyone got so distracted and angry about, well, who goes in what bathroom? Then in like 2016, around the time Trump is elected, we really start to see this ramp up into like full-blown sex isn't real, it's a social construct, or sex and gender are completely isolated from one another, so a biological male can be a female, and blah, 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 blah. I don't need to rehash all this, you've heard it all, you know it all. But the timing is just sort of interesting, considering that there was like an awareness arising among American working people that they were ultimately, regardless of whether they were on the left or the right, getting fucked by people who were both in power on the left and the right. Then suddenly, boom, this great divide and conquer tactic just spills out of the universities and into the streets. And well, hot damn, wouldn't you know it, just in time, at the same time, the solution to this ridiculous problem of wokeness or social justice warriors immediately presents itself. I mean, boom, right there, right on schedule. Here is Donald Trump. Here is MAGA 2016. Immediately arising on the scene as a repudiation of all of this dumb shit. And I speak in such harsh terms about this wokeness stuff, by the way, partially because I actually genuinely believe it is dumb bullshit, but also because it's that sort of language that I think generally summarizes how most normal people feel about it. In my experience, most like normal working class types of folks, who I'm around quite a bit, as everyone who listens to this knows for the billionth time I work at a factory, most people don't really care about, like, the trans stuff or race stuff. Like, people are just kind of cool with everyone. I know that might sound crazy to somebody who buys in to the leftist woke bullshit, but it's actually not really true in my experience. Most people are just kind of fine. Are like, you know, whatever, just so long as you don't bother me. Of course, some people may have, like, slight in-group preferences or whatever, and you know what? Tough. Get over yourself. You're not getting rid of that, and is it really that terrible? Whatever. That's a fucking rabbit hole that I don't care to go down currently, because it'll just deviate everyone's attention away from what I'm trying to talk about. Most people are just sort of fine with whatever people want to do. No one really cares about gay, or even trans, or black, or Mexican, whatever, in my experience. Maybe it's just that Northeast Ohioans are exceptionally cool. I don't know. But that's just my experience. So because most people see themselves as relatively cool with all of the shit that people do, or who they are, who other people are, when normal people were told, you're a bigot, you're a racist, you're a piece of shit, you hate this group, you hate that group's suffering because of you, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, of course people are naturally like, whoa, who the fuck are you to tell me who I hate or how good of a person I am, especially when it's coming from a blue-haired college chick. So most normal people, even people who are accepting of other races or other genders or other sexual identities, whatever, they think of this woke stuff as stupid bullshit, not because they're racist or bigoted, but because it's so, like, cartoonishly extreme. And so, there you go. Just explain the rise of Donald Trump. That's why it happened. That's why Donald Trump was insanely popular amongst, like, working class, normal people. People who maybe even traditionally would have voted Democrat. They moved over to him because this insane cartoonish wokeness was just a bridge too far for normal people. Now, I understand that there's more to Donald Trump's victories than just outright wokeness, but if you think about it, the other things that really catapulted him into the White House, immigration, policing, and the economy, these also actually tie back to wokeness. So why is it that the liberals are just letting people pour over the border like crazy? Well, because they're woke, and they think that just anybody could come here, as if we have unlimited resources. It's fine. We need to be compassionate. Why is it that cities are being flooded with crime? Well, because they're woke, and they don't want to enforce the laws because that would be racist or bigoted or whatever. We need to be compassionate. And why is the economy going so badly? Well, because go woke, go broke. So this is why I say that wokeness was really, and is still, really the fuel that the MAGA machine is burning. All right, so now I've already said that I believe wokeness was itself implanted into our culture. Now, was MAGA then just an organic response to this implantation? Well, I don't really think so. I don't believe that the MAGA movement was entirely organic. Now, I'm not saying that people weren't genuinely pissed at all this woke stuff, and I'm not saying that an organic following didn't emerge. But ultimately, I think that Donald Trump and his MAGA movement were themselves also a fabrication of the deep state. It was and is a manufactured response to a manufactured problem, wokeness. Now, really getting into all that here would turn this off-the-cuff episode into a long-form essay episode, and I want to avoid that. So in the show notes, I'll just include some links to really good articles and podcasts sort of dealing with the deep state connections that MAGA has. Specifically, there are some articles by Whitney Webb, articles by Ian Davis at Podcasts with Whitney Webb, James Corbett. Once again, I'll mention that series of articles by Corbett that I talked about earlier. I'll include some really heavily detailed stuff in there for you to check out if you want to get into the nitty-gritty of how MAGA itself is actually not a ground-up grassroots movement. Really, it is a top-down thing. It's a top-down thing that feeds off of the anti-woke sentiments that themselves are the result of a manufactured movement, namely, wokeness. Ultimately, each of these seemingly opposed movements serve the same general objective. That general objective is transhumanism, technocracy, or what I have dubbed techtopianism. That is what we need to be keeping our eye on. Now, I'm not one of these guys who thinks that just because this like sort of surface level culture war stuff is in fact a distraction means that we shouldn't talk about it or focus on it at all. We should. Culture is actually extremely important. And this is, I think, one of the best tricks that the so-called deep state is able to throw at us. They're not distracting us with shit that doesn't matter. They're distracting us with shit that does matter and then demands our attention. But then also the main thing also demands our attention. It's an overwhelm strategy because we have to put out all these small fires, but then also the big fire. Because, you know, the big fire is what's causing all of the little fires. But if we just focus on the big fire, those little fires are also going to burn a lot of shit up. So, like, we need to attend to all of it. And that's the trouble. That's why it's so effective. And that's why it's so pernicious and, in a sick, cynical way, ingenious. We do need to fight the culture war. We do need to be paying attention to these things. We do need to talk about the metaphysical categories of male and female. We do need to figure out this whole race thing and the immigration thing. All of these things are important. We can't just ignore them because we want to talk about this abstract ultimate problem of technocracy. But that abstract problem of technocracy is also very real and important and is the ultimate goal for the deep state actors who are causing all of these other problems. We need to attend to all of that, and it's extremely difficult. That's why it's a good move on their part to inflict all of this on us. So here, I'll put it this way to give you an example. Oh, the whole transgender thing, that's just a big distraction. Don't pay attention to it. Well, transgenderism, if that's even what it's supposed to be called now, I have no idea. These terms are constantly changing, which itself, by the way, is another move to constantly keep changing words and definitions so nobody knows if what they're saying is accurate or not. Go back and check out episode 26 for more on that. But anyway, this whole transgender thing, oh, don't pay attention to it. It's just a distraction. Well, no, because actually, as far as I'm concerned, the popularization and mainstreaming of transgenderism is a way of mainstreaming the idea that normal, healthy human bodies ought to be augmented. It's putting into our culture this idea that the consciousness part of the human and the material body part of the human are divorced from each other, and that the body ought to be subjected basically just to the whims of the consciousness, that there's no sort of push and pull interplay between the consciousness and the body. This is a very disruptive metaphysical take. It redefines what a human being is. It basically says that the material body, as it is now, is an ineffective, incomplete avatar for what we actually are, quote unquote. And so we need to turn to science, like literally science, surgery, pharmaceutical medicines, etc. We need to turn to science in order to make our body fit what our minds, what our consciousnesses say we want to be or ought to be. The body becomes sort of like a weird Mr. Potato Head type of thing. So you can swap genders, or you can keep your body as it is, but you can redefine what gender means so that I can have a dick and balls but be a chick, or you can have a fucking box and be a dude that, you know, you could be a menstruating man, a pregnant man. It's turning the body into something other than what we have always understood it to be. The body has become, like, not even secondary, but just like this almost irrelevant consideration to be toyed with and tampered with. All that matters is the, I'm not going to say rationality, just like the sort of desires, the appetites of the mind. That's what really matters. And of course, go back and listen to episode 20, Doomsday Device. This is a necessary metaphysical precondition for the ultimate embrace of transhumanism. You know, let's just remove our consciousnesses entirely from our gross material bodies and insert ourselves into some sort of virtual world in which our avatars can be constantly transformed according to our whims, our appetites, our desires, our feelings. So, see, in a way, dealing with the so-called little fire of transgenderism actually becomes a way of dealing with a core problem of the big fire, transhumanism. The trick is figuring out how to most effectively deal with the little fire, the transgenderism, without getting caught up in too much of like the surface level distraction clickbait bullshit, but actually bringing that conversation down to the important metaphysical point, which is, what is a human being? We gotta keep our eyes on the target, folks. But yeah, so that's one of the left-wing, quote-unquote, ways of feeding into the fire of transhumanism, techtopianism, etc. But then the so-called response to all of this, the so-called response to the left, coming, of course, from the right, well, what is that? We all know that they reject the whole, like, transgender thing, but then they bring in Elon Musk, Mr. Self-Driving Car, Mr. Brain Chip, and self-described advocate for technocracy, in order to basically gut the government, which, by the way, cool, fine with that, but he's using, like, AI to do it. He wants AI to be, like, further ingrained into government. He believes that government should rely on computers, on artificial intelligence, in order to be more efficient, more effective. And, of course, government efficiency, while in and of itself sounds really good, it's also one of the hallmarks of traditional technocracy. And certainly the way in which he's going about implementing his government efficiency program is in line with technocratic means and ends. And then, of course, he got Trump on, like, his second day, I think it was, in office, bringing in Larry Ellison of Oracle to talk about AI, vaccines, mRNA. Like, and then, of course, let's not forget that the whole mRNA COVID so-called vaccine, that was Trump's baby. That was Operation Warp Speed. Trump still has not actually said anything about the problems regarding the vaccine, so-called. Yes, he says, oh, well, I don't want it to be mandated. Great, sure, me neither. And I wouldn't stop anyone from getting it if they really wanted it. But that was his thing. And it's really funny how the vaccine for COVID became such like a left-wing issue, even though it was Trump's. And yet his own base were, those were the people who weren't taking it. It's very interesting. I'm still not exactly sure what to make of that, although I've got some ideas, but I'll wait for them to develop before I report them to my public. But anyway, for much more on this particular issue, like specifically regarding Elon and how he ties into the sort of MAGA deep state apparatus, and how ultimately this apparatus ties into the ultimate deep state goal of technocracy, transhumanism, and my term, techtopianism, I highly recommend that you guys check out the show notes, specifically the two-part series written by Ian Davis for Unlimited Hangout. Very long articles, these two, but believe me, they are well worth your time. My point here is that both so-called sides of the current political spectrum in America are marching us towards Techtopianism. You'll notice that when the right wing, the MAGA people, reject the liberals, the left, the woke, they don't reject them because they're technocrats. They reject them because, oh, they're a bunch of woke faggots or whatever. And the left, they don't reject the right, the MAGAs, because they're technocrats. They reject them because they're a bunch of bigoted assholes. So the left and the right going to war is really just a shadow play on the cave wall, when really it's the technocrats who are the puppet masters in front of the flame. It's so easy and common for people, especially in the alternative media, to get caught up in the small game of politics, of dwelling on the perceived switch of the Democratic and Republican Party interests. And I'm sure you've heard it a million times, like, oh, you know, isn't it crazy that 20 years ago, Democrats were anti-war and Republicans were pro-war, and now the Democrats are pro-war and the Republicans are anti-war? Well, all right, that's not totally even true now, but I get your point. Sure, I understand what people are saying when they say that, but come on, man, we could have a little better analysis than that. Better than just like, well, ain't it funny how, you know, come on, we can do better. It's not like political parties haven't changed before in this country. Parties change drastically, even if they maintain their original name. But they don't change drastically in terms of furthering the interests of oligarchical power structures. They change on the surface level, in the small game of politics. I see these shifts as serving two functions. One, to create the sort of illusion of change, that like, oh wow, parties evolve, parties shift. So maybe they are genuinely reflecting the democratic will of the people, because otherwise, why would they be changing? Well, they're changing to give that exact illusion. Because again, ultimately, no matter what changes occur within the parties, like I said, they're ultimately going to serve the oligarchs and the ultimate utopian vision of technocracy that dominates our time. But the other function is, in fact, to roll with changing public sentiment. If you go back to episode 39, the crowdwork episode, I try to drill down this point very clearly, that propaganda doesn't just spring out of nowhere. Propagandists have to work with the material, the mental material, that's available. So people's minds in the public do change. There are consciousness shifts. We're not all just robots. So these parties have to adapt to that in order to capture that energy. So if the people, let's say, for example, are starting to get sick of a bunch of wars, it would be wise of a party that wants to stay in power and maybe even continue these endless wars in some form or another, it'd be wise of that party to kind of wear a mask of anti-war, to adopt the rhetoric of anti-war, to match the changing energy. Oh, wow, the party changed. We'll see about that. It seems to me that the only changes that actually occur within the small game of politics, when the real game is the manipulation and guidance of human conscious energy to secure tacit consent from the masses, consent for the oligarchs, the utopians' actions. That's the game. Manipulation of conscious energy. I suppose another result of this sort of like party shake-up thing, now I don't know if this is on purpose, but I'm sure it's noticed, is to kind of increase the implicit or tacit madness within these like skit-sized normies who buy into the system. Because if you're just a normal person who was a Democrat 30 years ago, and you just continue being a Democrat, the party changes underneath you, but you're so roped into just being a Democrat, whatever that means to you, that the party could change 180 degrees, and you might not even necessarily notice. Or, because you're just so loyal to your brand, you might just march right along with those changes, even though they're directly repugnant to things that you would have held dear 30 years ago when you became a Democrat. Manipulating consciousness, breaking brains, that's what's going on here. I guess another thing that the whole party shakeup phenomenon caused, at least for a moment, was back in 2016, Pretty much everyone that I talked to was convinced that Hillary was going to win. Like, it was obvious. Donald Trump was there to lose to her. But then he won. And so I remember speaking to people, and a lot of us were confused. Like, okay, hold on. How did this guy win? Why did this guy win? And there was some talk, like, are we wrong about how presidents actually become presidents? Maybe it really is people just vote and that's what happens. Maybe there isn't some kind of plan. Or even if there is, maybe it's not such a sure thing all the time. Like, maybe Trump actually won because it was inconceivable that Donald Trump at that point would have been the establishment's chosen candidate, chosen leader, chosen winner. I remember hearing some talk like that. And for me, I was like, well, I don't know, because Trump is definitely in bed with sketchy people. He's definitely got deep state ties. So I wasn't willing to go that far, but I did hear that talk and I got it. I understand why people would kind of be confused. So I guess the function that this party shift caused that I'm speaking of now was to sort of sow doubt in the minds of those people who are skeptical of the system. Cause it was almost the first victory of Trump was almost like saying, hey, it's not rigged. Anyone can win. There is no puppet master. But now I think it's pretty clear that that is not true. And I'm pretty well certain that Donald Trump is in fact the anointed leader who will carry out the deep state's bidding and not some rogue who's going to buck the system and bring it all crashing down. And so then also that raises the point that the people who maybe thought that way in 2016, that, oh, maybe everything is legit because this guy was able to win. That type of thinking still sort of buys into the left-right false dichotomy that we have in this country, the divide and conquer narrative that, like, Hillary was clearly evil, which is true, but the anointed candidate, Donald Trump, is just a stupid Republican and he's a clown and a goofball. So there's no way he could win, but also his rhetoric is kind of good. Like, he talks about wanting to get out of these wars. He said something about how, like, America is responsible for the creation of ISIS. You know, he would say things that, quote-unquote, conspiracy-minded people would agree with. It was just assumed by some people that only one side of the aisle in that particular election was actually controlled, that Trump was genuine, if not maybe a little misguided and ridiculous, and then Hillary was just this deep state actress. Of course she is, but Donald Trump is too, an actor. But Trump really was a very interesting figure because I've encountered multiple people in normal life who say right straight out that before 2016, they never gave a shit about politics at all ever in their lives. And then 2016 hit and Trump came on the scene and started talking shit. And now these are like the most political people I know, the most obsessed with just the small game politics stuff, the cable news, Fox, whatever the new Republican stuff is now, Truth Social, MAGA, all of it. These guys go hard into it, who never cared about politics even a little bit before Donald Trump came in. So Donald Trump, with his populist energy, was able to just capture and politicize so many apolitical people and bring them into his camp, which, of course, I suggest is furthering technocracy. So here we are again back to the party shakeup serving the purpose of manipulating conscious energy in the masses in order to gain their tacit consent to the construction of a technocratic utopia. All right, so I've got plenty more to say on this subject. I wanted to do some, like, historical parallels. That's actually sort of what spawned the idea for this episode, specifically thinking about the French Revolution, the Thermidorian reaction, and then also some commentary on how people like to compare current times to Weimar Republic Germany, juxtaposed to the later rise of the Nazis. I have some thoughts on that that maybe are unconventional in alt-media circles. But I said I wanted to keep this episode short, and I know every time I say that, I wind up going for 2-3 hours. This time I'm actually going to stick to it. I'm going to keep this one short. So I'm not going to get into the French Revolution or into 1920s, 30s Germany this time. Maybe I'll do a little follow-up to this off-the-cuff episode with another off-the-cuff episode. We'll see. But certainly there is much more to say on the current moment here in America. And I will just sort of leave it with this, because I like to try and identify the tactics that the powers that be employ in this great war for their utopian vision that is waged all around us. MAGA has promised the American people to put out a whole bunch of little fires. We're going to officially recognize that there are only two genders. We're going to end DEI. We're going to defund any schools that mandate the COVID so-called vaccine. We're going to ban pharmaceutical ads. We're going to get Steak and Shake to use beef tallow instead of vegetable oil. But in exchange for all that, we're going to throw some more wood on the big fire. We're going to continue the march towards transhumanism, technocracy, techtopianism. It's a trick of human psychology that powerful people have understood for a very, very long time. That people will accept a drastically worse future if they are guaranteed a moderately better present. In a weird way, there is a kind of pragmatism to this mindset, because you could say, well, look, we're going to get, right now, these tangible goods. Right now. So that's a guarantee. And yeah, sure, down the line, things might get kind of screwy. But we have time to kind of sway the ship onto a different course. So there's no guarantee that the future is going to actually be super horrible. There's no guarantee that, for example, the MAGA movement has to lead into technocracy. Perhaps we can take the tangible goods it's giving us now and, through like grassroots political pressure, steer the MAGA ship away from technocracy, away from transhumanism, away from techtopianism. And so why not try it? Let's take the good we can get now and then just deal with the future as it arises. And, you know, sure, that sounds reasonable, but it overlooks the fact that these political movements, these populist movements, MAGA included, perhaps MAGA especially, exist not to be driven by the grassroots, but to capture and direct the grassroots. MAGA is a psychological grassroots capturing mechanism. It's what it's for. Case in point, the fucking COVID shot. That was Trump's thing. And his base rejected it, and that did literally no damage to him whatsoever. He made the shot. His people didn't like the shot, and yet somehow we've been so brainwashed and brain broken in this fucking country that his people completely divorced the shot from him, even though he continued to brag about the shot. Let's not pretend that people in groups are rational actors. You're not going to use your grassroots political bullshit to direct the MAGA ship away from technocracy. That's where it's fucking going. That's why that ship was built. And the more you think that you can use your democratic power to steer that ship, the more you're just buying into it. The more you're just giving up yourself to this mechanism. It's supposed to make you think that you're in control of it. That's the point. That's the ultimate illusion of democracy, of populism. It gives you the idea that you're steering it. You're fucking not. You're certainly not going to steer it away from its prime directive. Ugh. Well, so I guess I kind of gave you two tactics there. The first one being short-term goods in exchange for long-term awful, and the promise of false control, also known as democracy. All right, I said I wouldn't go long, so this is where I'm stopping it. Good night, everybody. Monday, Monday.
trust that day. Monday, Monday, sometimes it just turns out that way. Oh, Monday morning, you gave me no warning of what was to be. Oh, Monday, Monday, how could you leave and not take me? Every other day,
every other day,
every other day, every other day of the week is fine, yeah. But whenever Monday comes, you can find me crying all of the time.
Monday, Monday, so good to me. Monday morning,
Monday, Monday.